people, welcome to Have Guitar Will Travel, presented by Vintage Guitar Magazine, with your host, me, James Patrick Regan, otherwise known as Jimmy from the Deadlies. And today I'm speaking with Mark Diamond, guitarist with the band The Dwarves. He's known as the Fresh Prince of Darkness. In our conversation, Mark tells us about the trials and tribulations of living in LA and his history with The Dwarves, including 26 years with the band and writing and playing on the new album, Jenkum. Mark discusses growing up in the San Fernando Valley in California and his exposure to music, including taking a lesson from Nino DeFranco from the DeFranco family. And he tells us about his heroes, Steve Jones, who he met, and Johnny Thunders and Keith Richards. Mark describes getting signed early on during the end of the hair band era and the disappointments of the record industry at that time. Mark takes us through why he stopped touring and his day job as a teacher and his role in choosing the touring guitarist for the Dwarves. Mark describes his gear now and through the years and the need for cheaper guitars for touring and the ease of having support acts provide backline. To find out more about Mark, you can go to the Dwarves website, thedwarves.com. That's thedwarves.com. Please subscribe, like, comment, share, and most of all, review this podcast. I'd really appreciate it. And please support Vintage Guitar Magazine and all the wonderful things they do for us guitar players, because they do so many wonderful things for us guitar players. And hey, if you want to support the show, we have a Patreon. It's patreon.com/haveguitarwilltravelpodcast. Here's my buddy Mark. Hey there, Mark.
Hey.
How are you?
I'm good. we have a publicist?
You do. Well,
yeah, sure. That's news on me.
Oh, look, I get a tour of your house. That's great. Where are you at?
I live in La Crescenta.
La Crescenta.
Yeah, so it's kind of like north of, it's way up in the hills, like north of, where are you at?
I'm in Napa, California.
Oh, okay. So this is like, it's L.A.,
yeah,
but it's like kind of way up at the top of the mountain.
Yeah.
Kind of up there.
How's it feel to be so close to the nature?
You know, it's interesting. If you go to the bottom of my driveway, you can see downtown L.A.
Oh, wow.
But it's like a whole different world.
Sure.
I see deer most morning, and, you know, we get bears on the street and shit like that.
Right on. All right. Any worries about fires and stuff like that?
Well, that's a big worry.
Oh, okay.
You know, between you and me, what, you know, when you buy a house, the first thing you ask is your insurer, hey, can you insure this house?
Sure.
And they're like, yeah, no problem, you know. So I bought the house, you know. House insurance with fire was like, you know, I don't know, $2,400 or something like that a year. It was fine.
Yeah.
You know.
Do you have a massive toy collection, too?
Oh, it's a massive everything.
All right,
collection. Right. Whatever kind of physical media.
Yeah, yeah.
I like movies and shit like that.
That's badass. I love it. That's great.
Crap and a lot of shit in here, you know.
Yeah.
But yeah, you know, like 3 months later after buying the house, I get a lot of amps,
mm-hmm.
a lot of guitars.
Yeah.
I get a letter from them saying, oh, it turns out we had your address wrong, and you're really close to the mountains, and, you know, we're going to have to drop you or raise you because of the fire danger.
Oh, fuck that.
And I say, well, bullshit, because the bills made it to my house. So you didn't have the wrong address.
Yep.
The bills made it here, no problem. So fuck you. And ever since then, I've seen my rates go from $2,400 a month to about $9,000.
Damn. A month?
Yeah. No, year.
A year. Okay.
I'm sorry. $2,400 a year to $9,000. It's just been crazy up here.
Yeah.
Once, you know, the last fire, the Altadena fire, they just, you know, and the California insurance guy won't do anything.
Of course not.
You know, it's like State Farm, and their whole thing is, you let us raise rates or we'll leave, and then no one has insurance.
Yeah. Yeah.
So they agree to whatever, you know, the fuck they ask for, and it's just, it's been a drag.
Yeah, yeah. You grew up in L.A.?
Yeah.
What part of L.A. did you grow up in?
I grew up in the San Fernando Valley.
Okay, all right.
Yeah, I grew up in a town called Tarzana, like
sure.
Tarzana, Rosita.
Yep. Right on. And how long have you played in the Dwarves?
I was in the Dwarves for 26 years. So the first record I played on was 1999, Come Clean.
Wow.
I came in, did a bunch of the solos and this little extra stuff, but I wasn't touring with them yet.
Uh-huh.
I didn't tour with them and actually was in the band until 2001.
Okay.
I toured all the way until about a year ago.
Yeah.
I stopped touring. But, you know, I did all the guitar on the new record and wrote a bunch for that and stuff like that.
Yeah. Well, just to... I mean, it's no understatement to say the new record is fucking fantastic.
Oh, cheers. Thank you. I'm glad you dig it.
It's great pop, you know, rock to say. I mean, I don't know. It's great. It's fantastic. I hate categorizing things because I don't want to offend anybody, but I love it is what I want to say. It's like,
well, no, I appreciate that. You know, it's interesting. I was kind of iffy on it. Of all the records, I've done a lot of records, a lot of bands, and I've been in the Doors for 26 years. I've never put out a record in any band I've been in that I liked every song on it.
Yeah.
So concept album by the Doors. And that was a big one. It was like 26 songs or whatever we ended up doing.
Yeah.
That was the first one where I'm like, I like the way everything came out on this.
Uh-huh.
So, you know, this one, I was kind of like, yeah, I don't know. We'll see how it goes. But people seem to like it. So, you know, that's cool.
Yeah.
It's different. But I'm glad people seem to enjoy it.
Yeah. Well, I definitely enjoy it. And so growing up in the San Fernando Valley, when did you pick up guitar? When did you start playing guitar?
You know, man, I was probably like 12 or 13, mm-hmm. I guess. I took one lesson. It's a funny story. My mom had an old acoustic and I'd kind of bat around on that. And I found out if you put a microphone in it that goes into a tape recorder into your stereo and turn it really loud, it kind of distorts.
Yeah.
You know, you're trying to sound like Van Halen or something. And,
sure.
You know, I mean, this is, you know, it's a shame because, like, now, you know, nowadays, if I can't quite figure out that lick, you go on YouTube and there's some 12-year-old Japanese girl who teaches you how to play it. You know what I mean?
Sure.
And I'm like, oh, that's how they do it. That's awesome. Back then, it was really just like any record you got, you came home and you put it on, you just played and played and played. There was a place out there called Big Valley Music that was the local music store.
Uh-huh.
And I didn't know it at the time. But the store was run by the DeFranco family. Now,
okay.
Do you remember the DeFranco family singers?
Yeah.
Heartbeat, It's a Love Beat?
Yeah.
I didn't know this. I went in and took one lesson. But I had already taught myself enough that I kind of didn't like someone saying, oh, your finger's wrong, or do it this way. Because, like, I kind of play things wrong because I never had someone, you like, my pinky doesn't do a lot.
Yeah.
You know, it's just the way I taught myself. But it turns out I found out, like, a couple years later that the one lesson I took was from Nino DeFranco.
Wow.
Who was, like, the cute one in the DeFranco family singers. But that was my one guitar lesson. But basically, man, you know, taught myself. A good friend of mine from like junior high through high school was a guy named Mike Dimkich, who's in Bad Religion now.
Okay.
He was really naturally good. He used to show me stuff. We were the same grade, same age, but he was better than me. So I learned a lot off him as a kid. And, you know, just after that, you know, I started making records and shit pretty early, whether or not I knew what I was doing, but
And were you playing in bands in high school and stuff?
Yeah, I mean, I was playing in bands in high school, and then a band that I was in got signed, I guess, like my second year of college when I was like 19 or 20.
Wow.
Did a record for Chrysalis.
Wow.
It didn't exactly set the world on fire, but it was a good experience, and you know, I played with some good people on that record, and you know, ever since then I've, you know, I played in a bunch of different bands and toured with a lot of different bands, but, you know, the Dwarves was pretty great because, you know, I did that for 26 years. That was a great opportunity to do that. And, you know, bunch of shit.
Yeah. How'd you get hooked up with the Dwarves?
I was in a band called New York Loose that did a record for Hollywood Records.
Uh-huh.
And Hollywood had money. So even though they didn't know how to fucking sell a record or get one in the stores, they had money. So, you know, it's the only time I ever had a bus, you know, and I had like a guitar roadie, you know, some guy.
Yeah.
Hey, you want me to change your strings every night? I'm like, no, why'd you go find drugs and change them once a week? You know, make yourself be useful. I don't care if they're changed every day. I think that's dumb. You know, I never change strings. Anyways, one of those guys was a guy named Trevor, who was a roommate of Blag's.
Okay.
Yeah, we became friends. And, you know, I'm like, what else do you do? He's like, well, I work with the Dwarves. And I'm like, oh, that's cool. I know the Dwarves. I like them. And he's like, well, they're kind of looking for a guitar player right now. They're not getting along with their guy.
Yeah.
And he's the one who suggested me to Blag. And that's when I came in and I finished up solos and just little extra things on the Come Clean record.
Sure. And who were your guys, like when you're growing up, who were your guitar guys?
You know, man, Ramones was huge.
Yeah.
Ramones was huge. I was really into Black Sabbath first, but it was too hard for me to play.
Uh-huh.
I couldn't figure it out. And for years, when I got like older, I learned like how to tune down to D. I go, well, it's heavy, it's low, it must be in D. It wasn't until, you know, way later that I realized that they play everything in standard tuning, but just tuned way down. I didn't really know that. So originally I figured out a lot of those licks in a drop D tuning.
Uh-huh.
But for me, man, you know, it's Steve Jones,
yeah.
Keith Richards. Steve Jones was, you know, like the guy that, you know, Steve Jones is one of those guys that even when he tried to put out a bad metal record, he just plays tasteful. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
He's just one of those guys. He just plays badass Chuck Berry licks, minimal notes, but they're all great. And, you know, his shit was all based on Johnny Thunders, who's another guy that I still listen to. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Yep.
And it's just like, you know how it is, man. It's like, you know, when you're a kid, you know, before the internet and MTV and shit, you know, you read an interview and if Chuck Berry says, oh, you should check out a guy named, you know, Chuck Berry, you know, then you'll go listen to it as a kid. You know what I mean? You know, Steve Jones, you know, would name check Johnny Thunders. And
yeah.
Eventually you realize it all came down pretty much to Chuck Berry.
Sure.
You know, and stuff like that. But, you know, I was a, you know, Les Paul through a Marshall, that's Steve Jones, you know.
Yeah.
Junior through a Marshall and a Twin, that's Thunders. And, you know, or through a Deluxe, you know, whatever, that still pretty much works. So that's, I've never used really anything very different, you know.
Yeah.
You know, again, Keith was one of those guys that somebody finally showed me a drop G, and they're like, oh, well, now I can play everything.
Yeah.
And I was playing things that were kind of wrong, you know, but I didn't have like an older brother or someone to show me that stuff. So
yeah. You
kind of stumble upon shit like that eventually, and it made you better.
Sure.
But Jones, Thunders, Keith Richards, ZZ Top,
uh-huh. All
the old ZZ Top, which was kind of, they were always interesting because he's just unbelievable
yeah. In
taste and tone and everything. And it was really way too hard for me to play, but it's also very simple. You know yeah. What I mean?
Yep.
That's what made them great. You know what I mean? It's real simple. You could play along with the licks. And even the solos, are, you know, he's not like doing speed runs or anything like that. You couldn't make it sound like him. But boy, it was a good place to learn. You yeah. Know what I mean?
Yeah.
So I remember playing along. And Cheap Trick was huge for me,
sure,
too.
Sure, sure, sure.
Huge Cheap Trick. I mean, like 1980, which I would have been 12. I think that was Budokan.
Yep.
Was that Budokan? That was that Start Me Up or Tattoo You?
I think so.
That's 80 or 81. So, I mean, like, those years are real formative to me. And I guess ZZ Top at that point, that probably would have been, like, around El Loco or something like that.
Yep.
Not sure of the timeline, but, yeah, those would be, like, the guys that I really, you know.
Yep. Did you ever have an opportunity? You were too young to see Steve Jones with the Sex Pistols.
I never saw him with the Sex Pistols. The Professionals kind of broke up or had that bad car accident before. I got really into Professionals.
Uh-huh.
You know what I mean? And I still have all those singles. My buddy, though, somehow when we were in high school, he became friends with Steve and played in a band with Steve.
Even though
he was 17, you know, or 18, whatever it was.
Uh-huh.
So I would come along and be like, I'll be the roadie and stuff like that, you know? You know, that's where I learned, you know, it's like, Steve, what do you play? You take a Les Paul. You put it through this amp, you put this green box in between, which is a tube scraper.
Yeah.
And that works, man. That's all I've ever toured with, man. That's just like, if I show up to a gain, an amp with gain, no matter what it is, you know, even if it's a crappy one, you know, if you got a Les Paul and a tube scraper, you can make it sound good.
Sure.
So I used to see Steve playing that. I can't remember what that band was called. They just played locally for a little while. But I'm like, hey, man, my friend's playing with Steve Jones. And that was kind of cool. And sometimes he'd be at the house, you know what I mean? It's like,
yeah. Hey,
that's your guitar hero. And, you know. It was kind of cool,
yeah.
You know, so that's the only time I got to see him, you know.
Yeah.
I saw the Ramones and stuff as a kid.
Sure.
And I saw Thunders a couple of times. I actually saw Thunders really good once.
Oh, really?
I was proud of that. I saw a show where he, like, showed up and played an hour and a half, and didn't fall over, played songs. I mean, I've seen the other type of shows,
sure,
too.
Sure.
But he was actually, I always felt very happy that, you know, like, I've seen the Replacements play 2 hours at a Halloween party.
Wow.
I had a friend of mine who was older. He's like, there's a band. They're cool. They're playing a Halloween party at a place called Cal Arts. It's a liberal arts college.
Sure.
And if you drive, I'll take you. I'm like, okay. You know, he just wanted me to drive. But that was probably, like, right around when Hootenanny came out. I didn't really know him that much. Yeah, they came out because it was a show that didn't matter.
Yep.
So they came out and they played, like, you know, an hour and 50 minutes, Louder Than God, unbelievably great, tight,
wow.
You know, still with the fun covers, you know, but then you'd go, oh, they're great. You go see them, you know, when they play the big LA show,
yeah,
you know, 20 minutes and they'd vomit and fall off the stage. At least, you know, what people kind of wanted to see, but, you know, I was always happy to say I saw a good Replacement show.
Right on. Right on.
You know, that was a trip because I think Tommy was like my age, you know what I mean?
Uh-huh. Yeah.
You know, seeing that. And I do recall at that show, they were already doing Can't Hardly Wait.
Oh, wow.
Because years later, when it came out, I'm Pleased to Meet Me, I'm like, ah, they played that song back then. They always said they had it for a long time.
Uh-huh.
But I remember seeing them do it way back when. So,
wow. That's cool.
You know?
And you're probably too young for, like, the whole hair band era of the Sunset Strip.
The hair band thing was exactly right when my band got signed.
Oh, okay.
And the band, and that's when all those bands, you know how it was, man. You know, Guns N' Roses made $1 billion,
yeah.
So signed every single band.
Yeah.
And then we saw it happen again in Seattle. Nirvana made $1 million, so signed every single band. And most of those bands weren't very good, you know what I mean?
Yep.
And the reason why, I was in a band on Chrysalis called Broken Glass, right?
Okay.
You know, two of us had long hair, we played really loud. We'd open for, you know, Social Distortion one weekend, we'd open for, you know, Guns N' Roses the next weekend, whatever it was. But, yeah, we kind of wanted to be like the Replacements and do, like, we were doing country shit.
Uh-huh.
But, you know, at that point, like, all the big, dumb metal bands,
yeah.
You know, with the big poopy hairdos and the dumb clothes, they'd all been signed. And the only three bands really left in, like, that scene in Southern California who hadn't gotten a deal was Junkyard,
uh-huh.
Broken Glass, and The Hangman.
Okay.
Who were all kind of the rock and roll bands, but people weren't really sure what to do with them. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, The Hangman got signed to Capitol, put out a great Thunder-Z album. You know, they stuck him out on tour with Tora Tora or something like that. And that well, we got signed. I remember once they called, you know, why is there a bill for a pedal steel player? We said, well, it's for the country songs. They're like, why are you doing country songs? You know, meanwhile, at Chrysalis, you know, Slaughter was selling 1 million records a week. So we were very quickly forgotten.
Oh, yeah.
You know what I mean? I don't think it was the greatest record ever, but in we were trying to be the Stones or Replacements. We were young. We didn't really know what we were doing.
Uh-huh.
I feel if that record had come out after, like, maybe a year and a half later, the Black Crowes hit.
Yep.
I think people would have understood what we were doing more.
Sure.
That having that. But at that point, people, it was just all about, you know, metal and whatever. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
In Junkyard, you know, they actually did well. You know, and those are like kind of, and then the Sea Hags out of San Francisco. They're the other last one who are also on Chrysalis.
Uh-huh.
And one of the reasons we didn't get any push is that they spent so much fucking money on the Sea Hags. They got Mike Plank. That was the first record he did after Appetite.
Uh-huh.
It was on the Sea Hags. And every time they put the Sea Hags out, they get busted for dope and they get sent home and then they eventually OD'd and whatever. And, you know, when it came our turn, our record, they're like, yeah, we're not pumping any more money into these junky L.A. bands. Fuck you. They really didn't, you know. And, you know, our shit, I don't think it would have been a big hit, but it died pretty quick.
Yeah.
You know, years later, you know, the Junkyard guys are really good friends of mine. So years later, I did a number of tours with them.
Oh, right on.
I started playing with them when Brian joined Bad Religion.
Okay.
So if he was with Bad Religion, they'd call me if they wanted to do shows.
Uh-huh.
Then eventually I did like a tour of Spain with them. And those guys are all still really good friends of mine.
Yeah.
But that, you know, and that's how it was in L.A. at that time. It was just all the hair bands. And in my opinion, you know, the last couple bands that got signed were the rock and roll bands.
Sure.
And then there were some other, you know, like Jane's Addiction was different, you know.
Yeah.
Well, you know, stuff like that. But then the whole thing repeated in Seattle, you know?
Yep.
Yeah. Where everything signed, anybody from Seattle got signed. And there's some good ones, but there's a lot of crap, you know? So.
Sure. Yep.
This is how it is. I mean, it used to be they'd sign bands and, like, you know, you get 6 or 7 records, you know, to develop. And hopefully by then you have a hit. You know? Once people started selling $10 million out of the box, that was it.
Yep.
Because then, you know, economically, it's to sign everything. If one of them hits, we would just wipe the slate clean with all the other ones. So, you know,
yeah,
so, yeah. No, I was definitely there for them.
when the Doors rehearse, where do you guys rehearse?
We all live in different cities and different states.
Okay,
so it's kind of a big pain in the ass.
Yeah.
Basically, bass player Nick is a place in like a lockout space in downtown LA.
Okay.
We'll get together there, but like I said, the kid playing drums for us, he lives in Tucson, blags up in the Bay Area.
Yeah.
So we never, I mean, the entire time I've been in the band, you know, now I haven't been touring, so I got someone else doing it, but
uh-huh.
We never really rehearsed that much. You know what I mean? It was kind of like, all right, we'll get together, you know, the day before we fly to Europe, you know, the day before a tour, a couple of days, and rehearse a couple of times. So you had to kind of show up knowing your shit. And if you didn't, you know, that was stigma, you know what I mean? Know the stuff.
Yeah.
And then as far as like writing albums, everybody writes in the band. So we'd all write stuff and demo it to the best of our abilities.
Yeah.
And then, you know, get together and try to, you know, learn it as a band, the songs that we wanted to record.
Yeah.
But, like, you know, up until this last record, we had Josh Fries playing drums on, like, the last four albums.
Yeah.
Josh is very busy, you know what I mean?
Yes, he is.
So we'd be lucky if we got 1 2-hour rehearsal with Josh, and then we'd go into the studio the next day. And honest to God, it's usually like you do one take, and then you say, okay, hit record on this one. And that was usually the one. Like, he's that good, you know
yeah,
what I mean?
Oh, yeah.
You know, that's how we did, you know, Concept Album and, you know, Invented Rock and Roll. What was before that? Born Again, the other stuff Josh was on. It was very minimal, but he's good.
Yeah.
Some shit we wrote in the studio right then and there, you know what I mean? So, you know, so, yeah, we do it at Nick's in L.A., but, you know, maybe they're rehearsing more now. I don't know, but yeah. How come, I never rehearsed.
Yeah, how come you're not doing the tour?
Because I'm old. I've been touring for 37 years. You know what I mean? It's like, I got a kid, you know. Yeah. I've been gone for so much of her life. She's got one more year of high school. I don't want to miss things anymore.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? So I stopped touring about, yeah, maybe like a year, year and a half ago.
Yeah. Do you have to work a day job, or are you? What are you doing?
I teach school.
Oh, do you really?
Yeah, I teach school.
Right on.
Which is funny because, you know, like, you know, it's always a dream to quit your job and join the circus. You know what I mean?
Sure, sure, sure.
You go off and do it. And it's like, I've been in the circus, you know, since, I mean, I got signed when I was 20.
Yeah.
You know, until I was like 57. It's like, wow, man, this is what it's like not worrying about money. You know, it's like, it's kind of nice, you know?
Yeah.
Oh, I don't have to book a tour on my own because it's property tax month is coming up and shit like that. So it's like, I miss seeing my friends.
Sure.
And people that we know on the road.
Yeah.
Sitting in a van 7 hours a day and going to airports and shitty hotels, I don't really miss that.
No.
You know, they know I'm always available. You know, if somebody can't do something and it comes up, I'll do it.
Yeah.
I was going to do that Punk in the Park in Pittsburgh with them until the guy got canceled. Whatever. But I was going to go do that you know, which I'm always happy to do. But I just, you know, man, like I said, I'm 58. Yeah. I started doing this when I was 20, and I can't sit in a van 7 hours a day. Or, you know what I mean?
I totally understand.
I've done it. So I'm just kind of over it. So,
yeah.
I like I said, I miss seeing the dudes. I miss, like, rolling into town, going to cool record stores and shit like that.
Yeah.
The people that I know in different cities. But the actual touring, it's been so nice not going to the airport multiple times, you know, a month. I've really enjoyed that, you know. you know, I mean, I like traveling and seeing new places, but kind of done everything. So
yeah, I got you.
I guess I'm kind of over it.
Well, I got you 100%. Did you have a hand in the guy who's playing guitar for the tour?
Yeah, the guy, there's two guys who have been doing it. One's a guy who plays with Nick and his other band, Mondo Generator. He's an old friend of ours.
Mm-hmm.
So I got together with him. Yeah, you know, he's good. He figured everything out. But then I showed him, you know, what I actually do at different spots and the solos and stuff like that. The other guy's a young dude named Ginger, Gianluca Panera. He's a guy that we met. He was playing in a band called the Svetlanas that Blag produced a record.
Okay.
And I had written a song for them, and Nick played bass on one of their records. And he's a real good guitar player. So the same thing. I'm like, learn all these songs and come over a few times. So I trained him and showed him exactly what I play.
Yeah.
I think he's been the guy doing the bulk of the touring. So I think he's to be the guy doing most of the touring stuff this summer.
Mm-hmm.
Not sure, but yeah. So they're both friends. It's cool.
Yeah.
You know, I showed him all this is what I've been, you know what I mean? When you're in a band, it's like, you know, you play things different than the original way it is on the record.
Yep. Yeah.
And then it's like, so like, you know, you don't want to play, you know, you don't want to play less fuck the way it sounds on the record, which is brilliant, but there's no dynamics. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
You know, so the way me and Nick and, you know, and the drummers have been playing it for years is a much more different thing, you know, to give us, you know, showing the things that we do now and stuff like that. And also, you know, Blag's used to hearing certain things in certain parts, you know what I mean? Yeah. So I could go through and tell him, this is what I always used to do there. It was kind of a cue, you know what I mean?
Yep.
Whether or not it was actually on the original recording or whatever.
Yep.
So, but yeah, no, it's all chill. So yeah, those two guys, Mike Pygmy and Ginger, they're going to be the ones doing them.
Yeah.
And they're the guys who've been doing it for about the last year.
Okay. All right. You're playing the eighth notes, the very fast eighth notes. Are those all downstrokes?
I try to keep it downstroke, but sometimes it's too fast.
Yeah.
So I've got a pretty good wrist.
Yeah, you
do. So I can get that going, you know. And it's interesting, man, because I'm good friends with Richie Ramone. I did a record with him.
Okay.
Which I played all the guitar on, and I actually wrote a song for him on that record. And, you know, because we talked about, you know, Johnny Styles. That's where it comes from.
Sure.
you know, and he would tell me that what Johnny would really do is like a whatever, if you watch his hand. So he, even he wasn't always playing, but I can't do it like him, and I can't with on our super fast stuff. As much as I would like to say it's all 100% downstroke, sometimes I'm doing that. You know, you just got to be able to have it in your wrist and keep it in time.
Yeah, exactly.
If it's at the appropriate pace, then I'm all for 100% downstrokes.
Yeah.
But some of our shit's just so fast.
Yes, it's got to be.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I mean, like the end of that song, Ain't Playing With You on Concept record, that was Blag's tune, but he's like, write a whole speed metal part for the end. So I wrote that kind of old ministry type thing. Just There's no way I can play that downstroke. So it's all. Yeah. You know, the Mike Scoscia, you know, surf guitar type thing, you know.
Sure, sure.
But I'm all for downstrokes. Always for eighth notes.
So what does your amp and guitar collection look like at home?
So, you know, there's so many things as guitar players and musicians that we lose and we regret selling or something happened to. I've been fortunate that I've held on to most shit.
Right on.
You know, there's guitars that I've sold that I regret, but I bought a JCM 800 when I was 17, which is this amp. Been through a lot of shit. You see that one?
There it is, right there.
There it is. That's been on every Dwarves record since Come Clean. So it's just, you know, JCM 50-watt 800.
Yeah.
The other amp that I use in the studio, sometimes I'll use this orange I got from Joe from the Queers.
Okay.
Because when we were touring with them, all those tours, they would bring the back line, and I liked it, and he was getting rid of it.
Yeah. Or, is it an old one, that orange?
No, I don't believe it's that old. Okay. I don't know. It's a 100-watt rocker verb.
Huh. Okay.
I don't, it's not like one of the old 60s ones or everything. This Marshall would have been like an 86, I suppose, or an 85. I graduated high school in 86, so
okay.
I probably bought it like the year before. And then I used the Fender Deluxe a lot.
Uh-huh.
I like that.
Yeah.
Fender Deluxe is a good amp. Guitars, the 74 Custom.
Yeah.
That I've had since I was 16.
Right on.
It was in a fire. It was in a fire because this is one of those. This was, I had it because it was the Steve Jones guitar, you know?
Yeah, of course.
It was one of the, you know, 74 yellow ones. I was touring with a band and our bus caught on fire and burned down. And it was all fucked up. And we're actually, that was that band New York Loose. We were opening for Marilyn Manson on the Antichrist Superstar
wow.
tour.
Wow.
And we just threw all the shit in a box. Most of it was just gone. Uh-huh. But a couple days later, I started looking at it. I'm like, you know, there's nothing really wrong with the neck. And one of the Manson guitar tech guys, he's like, yeah, this thing's fine. Give it to me. And he put in a pickup. I think it's a Duncan. I don't know. I'm not very techy.
Uh-huh.
This was never reattached. And this has been on every Dwarves record.
Oh,
it's
right
got a
on.
Very unique kind of sound because, like, all the finish.
Yeah, yeah.
And then I've always been a Gibson guy.
Uh-huh.
He had a 72... Gold top.
Deluxe.
Deluxe.
Yeah.
Yeah. This is most of the last records, this guitar.
Okay.
And then as far as, you know, the other guitar that's on the new record, if it's not the gold top, it's this Junior.
Yeah, that's cool.
Double Cutaway Junior. The reissue came out in 2006.
Okay.
And, you know, I like SGs.
Yeah,
I like Fenders. I like Tellys. I hate Strats. I can never play Strats.
Yeah.
And then for touring, lots of times, I'll just buy cheapy copies because I didn't want to take shit out on the road.
Yeah.
I mean, I used this one for years with the Dwarves. It's you know, it's a Chinese copy, but, you know, I gave it some love and it's been fine.
Yeah.
I was out once doing a tour with our bass player, Nick, on the Generator. We were in Europe. He was paying me really good, so I brought the two Les Pauls.
Okay.
And they both went missing in the airport for like 3 days.
Wow.
I'm like, fuck, that's a 74 Custom and a 72 Deluxe, and they're gone.
Yeah.
And right as we're getting into the van to leave the hotel, the airline like truck pulls up, like, we haven't found your shit. And they found my guitar. They've been all over the place. They had all these weird stamps. And ever since that moment, I'm like, what? Why am I bringing nice shit on the road?
You know what I mean?
No kidding. So I don't want to bring nice stuff anymore. So, you know. This is the guitar that I bought. It's a cheapy Gibson. It has only gone to Mexico.
Okay.
Because I figured if I'm going to lose anything, it's going to get lost and stolen in Mexico.
Yeah, yeah.
I don't mean anything with that, but, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, I was doing a tour with this chick named Texas Terry. Ever heard of Texas Terry? I played guitar for her we got off for a tour in Spain. My shit came out, and the bass player, he had a nice telly bass. It just never came out.
Wow.
We asked, and everybody's like, oh, no, play English. And suddenly no one can speak anything. No one knows anything. So he just walked back through that door, the one with like the little flaps you're not supposed to walk back.
Yeah.
30 seconds later, he comes out with his bass.
Damn.
It was there. Somebody had seen it, liked it, and put it against the wall, was going to take it home after work.
Damn.
You know what I mean? So seeing things like that, I'm just like, you know what? I bring these cheapy things out on the road. When any kind of local show or a show where I just have to fly to San Francisco or somewhere close,
yeah,
then I'll bring nice stuff where I can bring it on the plane with me.
Yeah.
Anything else, man, I just fucking, I would tour with, I toured so many years, as you can tell, on my old guitars. I figured it was time to keep them safe.
Yeah,
and whatever touring I did now or in the last few years, it was all with just knockoffs. You know, the knockoffs were weird, man. There's a guy that we knew. He used to, like, one of those weird guys who just buy anything. Hey, I found a box of flares in my dad's garage from 1970. You know, he'd buy it. One day we got a call from that someone saying, hey, that guy just got 24 Gibsons from China.
Oh, wow.
And this is when Gibson was really actively stopping shipments and cutting the headstocks off and stuff, you know what I mean? Because I guess they were being made at the Epiphone factory, but the people were putting the Gibson shit on them and sending them out. And the guy was like, yeah, they're $400 each, but if you buy two, then I'll give it to you for $300. If you buy three, I'll give it to you this. So I called up all my friends who tour. We went down there, about eight of us, and we probably bought like 13 or 14 guitars between us. But brought it down to like $200 a guitar. And some of them, like that yellow one, I never did anything to. It's fine. I plug it in, it stays in tune, it's fine.
Yeah.
That one that I used for years, like that, I had to put in a pickup, a toggle switch, and a new bridge. And that's how they kind of were. Some of them were fine, you know, for what they were, and others needed a lot of love, and some had real big defects, and they're all very random. You can kind of tell, like, people went in and assembled them at night. But that white SG, I got that out of the recycler for $200.
Right on.
And the guy's like, it's not a Gibson. And, you know, it's not a Gibson. I'm like, no, it's fine. I know. I met him at a gas station. I'm like, yeah, it's fine.
Yeah.
I tour. I bring out cheap stuff as a backup guitar.
Yeah.
Yeah, so I'll pick that stuff up. I like it. You know, I mean, just like I said, unless it was something where I could keep an eye on stuff, I don't want to bring nice stuff out anymore.
Yeah. What about amps?
You know, with the Dwarves, smartest man in the world, honestly. My whole life, lugging around amps. Okay, that's part of the reason I hate too. I don't want to carry heavy shit. I'm old. You know what I mean? You get, when I went out with Junkyard, you know, I love those guys. I'm friends with them. We're in Spain. You know, well, I'll tell you the way the Dwarves do it, but I get with them. They're like, well, we got to go pick up the backline. I'm like, oh, fuck, you guys are carrying backline? They're like, well, yeah, of course we are, you know. Remember, they actually did well during the 80s and 90s.
Sure.
So a lot of times they still do things that way. I'm like, no, man, don't do that. So, you know, we go pick it up, which means you have to move it every night.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
With the Dwarves, we'd be like, you know, if it's our tour and you know, we want a cool band to open, but it's like, hey, look, if you want to open, you know, you're going to bring the gear.
Yeah.
So you got, you know, two Marshalls, you know, or something equivalent, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And an Ampeg, you know, and a drum set and whatever. And you're going to move it. You're going to set it up. But, you know, you're going to play, you know, to hundreds of people a night.
Yeah.
Whereas, you know, usually opening bands make, you know, play to nobody.
Sure.
And, you know, whatever you're getting paid, we'll pay you $100 a night. So if it's a 10-day tour, first day, we give them $1,000.
Right on.
You know? And so most bands would go for that, and they're used to playing through their own stuff. They're young, so they still think it's important. You know, I mean, I know a lot of bands who want to bring their own shit.
Yeah.
I know. I mean, like I said, man, if I don't have to carry it, I mean, like I said, when we tour, it works out. When you do the festivals, you can tell them that, you know, hey, man, it's got to be a tube amp, you know, whatever you want.
Yeah.
Sometimes you show up to some real rinky-dinky shit. You know, some real Fisher Price crap that happens, or hey, we got you Marshalls, and you know, one of the band's girlfriends walks in holding it over her head. And you're like, that's a valve state. If she can hold it over her head, that's a valve state, because I certainly couldn't hold a Marshall over my head.
No,
you know, it says Marshall. I'm like, yeah, it's not really a Marshall. Those are the worst, but yeah, man, you know, and the difference is, you know, bands have to get up at 9 a.m., hope their trailer's still there, full with their, you know, or you know.
Yeah.
And then you got to drive in the slow lane because you can't have a car in the fast lane with a trailer.
No.
And then you got to get to the venue by 3 p.m. to do load in and sound check, which usually means waiting for an hour, then spending another hour watching a sound guy twirl chords.
Yeah.
And then you got to stay to the bitter end and load it all up and hope it doesn't get ripped off. If you don't bring backline, you wake up at noon.
Yep.
You just go straight to, you know, to your hotel, sleep for a couple hours, get to the show around doors. And at the end, you're just responsible for two guitars.
Oh, yeah.
You know, snare and cymbals. And it's like, it works, man. And then you don't have to pay for a trailer. I mean, I did sound for years, too, at the Knitting Factory. And I'd see bands on tour. How long you guys been touring together? Oh, you know, like 2 months. I'm like, you ever think about sharing your fucking backline?
Yeah.
Because it'd be six bands. Each one's two Marshalls and an Ampeg. Two Marshalls and an Ampeg.
Yeah.
And I understand people wanting their own head or whatever. Fine. Share the fucking cabinets. Share the shelves. You know what I mean? It's like... And it's just like, yeah, it's heavy. We never wanted to do it. It's expensive, and it limits where you can park and what time you got to get up and when you can eat. And so we never, you know, sometimes I remember one time when I was first in the band, we were doing some show. Like it was like House of Blues. It was like us and Napalm Death. And I'm just like, okay, cool, man. I'm going to bring my shit, you know, and I'm tired of playing through other people's stuff. So, you know, I load up, you know, Marshall half stack, you know, some Fender or whatever, you know, bring three guitars. And it's like, that was the biggest mistake of my life, man. You know, I have to move all that shit in. I was like, okay, I see the genius of why we do this, you know.
Yeah.
And once in a while, like I said, we were doing a tour of the Queers, and they had an accident. And they didn't make the first show. And, you know, they always had great gear.
Sure.
So their shit didn't make it, you know. So I ended up going on stage. One of the opening bands, it was like a Line 6, you know, the thing you plug in. Like,
oh, yeah, of course.
Thing, you know, like a 12-year-old has in there. But, you know what? Fuck it, you know.
Yeah.
You know, out front, it probably sounds fine, and you just kind of learn not to really worry about that shit.
Yep.
Obviously, as a player, you want to be comfortable and know it sounds good. You know what I mean?
Yep.
This thing did not, but, you know, they can't all be winners. But, you know, you always got to remember that, too. Out front, no one can tell the fucking difference. You know what I mean? You can bring, you know, 30 fucking stacks. You know, there's still only mic and one speaker.
Exactly.
You know what I mean? So it's like, you know, I mean, to me, that was always a metal thing, was building a wall. One time, the Dwarves, man, we played main stage Castle Donington.
Wow.
Ozfest opening for the original Black Sabbath reunion with all the guys.
God.
And we played that, right? And like weeks before, they sent us this thing, what do you need? So they gave it to me, right? And I guess I didn't realize that I could have said, well, I need 8 full stacks on one side, and they'd have it. They had it. They had all the rollers. So I'm like, well, we need 2 half stacks and an Ampeg. So that's what they brought. And when you watch a video from that show, every single band has built this huge, crazy wall of shit. And we come out, and there's a half stack, and there's like 30 feet in the drum set, and then there's like a bass amp and whatever. But again, they only mic that up anyways, you know what I mean? And I was kind of proud of that. Like, oh, yeah, we didn't succumb to building the stupid wall, you know? That's all you really need. But, you know, the one thing I would do, there's different versions of the band. When he who was in it was 2 guitars, and a lot of the time it was just me. If there was another cabinet or another amp on the other side, I'd run an AB box because Nick would like to have guitar on his side.
Yeah.
And that made it sound kind of bigger. Okay. The real way to do it was Steve Jones actually told me when I was a kid. He would put a chorus set like on nothing in between because it just sort of separates the signal by like a few milliseconds.
Yeah.
And then it sounds like 2 guitars. But I, of course, never bought chorus pedals. I never did that. But that was all. I did invest in having a very long speaker cable so we could have guitar on both sides.
Yeah.
You know.
And were you always using a Tube Screamer?
I've tried other things, man, but, you know, like I said, when I was a kid, Steve Jones was like, get this green pedal. It makes everything sound good. And I'm like, that sounds good to me. And I see him put it in front of a Marshall or a Twin or whatever. I mean, honestly, I think a lot of that stuff comes down to the player. You know, if you have a sound, you're going to get it. But, you know, Steve always sounded like Steve no matter what he was playing through.
Oh,
you know
what
I mean? Yeah. But that works to me, you know. A lot of the pedals, you know, like we fuck with shit on like the albums and, you know, solos, you know, we'll try Big Muff and some other things and get kind of a different feel. But for the basic tones, to me, a big amp on, I think it was Keith Richards. He's like, a little amp on 10 will always sound better than a big amp on 2.
Oh, yeah.
Which is true because, you know, you're pushing the thing, you know what I mean? You know, that said, it's like the Tube Screamer, it just gives you a little more sustain and, you know, width, but it never sounds metal.
No.
All those pedals always sounded metal. I never wanted to sound metal, you know, and I just wanted to sound, you know, big and fat.
Yeah.
So I always liked them. You know, I tried a couple different things over the years, but to me, it's just, you know, if you have a Tube Screamer, you know, sometimes some shows you never even step on it because everything sounds great.
Yeah.
But if you do need to, you just know you can kick it over a little bit without sounding, you know, buzzsaw kind of shit, you know.
Yeah.
So he's the guy who taught me about it, and I always kind of swore by it. It's really the only thing I ever used.
Yeah. So outside of all the music stuff and your job, your teaching job, what do you do for fun?
Oh, I like being home, man. honestly, I've been, you know, on the road for so many years. It's like, it's this last year, just being able to go to all my daughter's events is great. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I'm a big movie fan, man. I love movies and shit like that.
Like what kind of movies?
I like genre films and stuff like that. You know what I mean? I like a lot of the horror stuff. Good movies, original movies, which there aren't a lot of. You know what I mean? So that's, you know, everything today is a remake or a comic book film. That's kind of, it's nice to see movies that are kind of made for adults, you know?
Yep.
Or with an original idea. But, you know, I mean, I still play guitar all the time.
Yeah,
you know?
Of course.
I read a lot. I'm a big reader. It's like, you know, I like just to sit outside and just read a book and listen to music. I mean, I go record shopping a lot. I'm still buying records all the time.
Right on.
You know what I mean? I always tell my wife and kid, I'm like, look, if I die tomorrow, don't just throw this shit away. It's worth a lot of money.
Oh,
you know
yeah.
I mean?
Yep.
All these fucking, you know, thousands of records and movies. And, well, the CDs probably aren't worth anything, but you know what I mean?
I think they're worth some.
I like going, you know, I mean, that was always the fun thing about touring, man. You know, we'd roll into a town and we'd just go hit whatever the coolest, you know, record store was and see what you find.
Yeah.
Everybody would come back with, like, you know, at the end of the tour, you'd have like your little bag full of records and shit like that.
Yeah.
I mean, I found a great Stones record in Hungary and in Budapest.
Wow.
That I've never seen anywhere. You know what I mean? I kept it safe through the whole tour and got it home. You know, things like that. You know, like to me, when I look through my records, it's kind of like a diary. I can go, oh, I remember I bought that when I was in high school. Or, oh, I got that at that weird record store with Nick that we found in, you know, Croatia or whatever. You know what I mean? So I like stuff like that. So right. I still love record hunting. But, yeah, I mean, I play guitar all the time. You know, I like watching the Dodger games.
Yep.
You know, there's a lot of Dodger games. My daughter's gotten really in. She loves the Dodgers. She's gotten really into hockey, too. So now I got to watch all the hockey games. But, you know, I always have a guitar in hand and try to figure new shit out.
Yeah, exactly. That's the best time to play is when you're watching sports.
Exactly. You know, there's always one within reach. But, you know.
Right on. Well, Mark, it's been a pleasure. And I hope I get an opportunity to meet you in person at some point here. But
yeah, you're up in Napa?
I'm in Napa, yeah.
Oh, fair enough. If you're ever down here, feel free to hit me up, man.
I will. I will for sure.
Cool. Well, thank you for having me.
Oh, my pleasure. Absolutely.
It's been all right, man. Take care.
You too. Bye-bye.
All right. Bye-bye.
Thanks for listening to Have Guitar Will Travel. You can catch up on all the things I'm doing at thedeadlies.com. And I'm on all the social media platforms as well. And please support Vintage Guitar and all the wonderful things they do, because they do many, many wonderful things for us guitar players. Thanks. Please subscribe. Please tell a friend. And I'll see you guys next week. Bye, guys.